Let's say you're hanging off a cliff and you're hanging on for dear life, and somebody's up there telling you to, hey, there's no problem, just let go,
You should meditate.
you should meditate. Yeah, be like me, I don't have any problems. And that, they give you a lot of theories about why that might be so. You're gonna feel some panic. And it's possible, you just giving an analogy, that if finally either you decide to let go or your fingers get so tired or somebody comes and pries them off the cliff and you start falling, you're going to feel panic. And maybe it turns out that the ground was just a foot below you, but you hadn't ever really looked at it because it's scary. And it turns out, oh, actually, that was scary, but no harm, I didn't die. But that doesn't make the anticipatory anxiety and the panic of openness go away. We have to go through that type of experience thousands of times to start, let's say, building, generating new neural pathways besides our evolutionary hardwiring.
What is that ground that is a foot away?
It's just that our drama of being an alienated significant self turns out to have no essential nature to it. It's like, I forget if we had mentioned one of Trungpa Rinpoche's quotes, which I like earlier. I'll say it again in case not, but that the bad news is we're falling through the air without a parachute, and the good news is there's no ground. So, more precisely, what we discover is there's no ground and it's not killing us. We're just falling through space until we don't.
Welcome to Mew. Today's episode is with Bruce Tift. Bruce Tift is a licensed psychotherapist and is the author of Already Free: Buddhism Meets Psychotherapy on the Path of Liberation. He is also a longtime practitioner of Vajrayana Buddhism and was a student of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. If you enjoy this content, consider helping to support it by joining our Patreon or making a donation at the link down below. And so with that, I'm very happy to introduce this interview with Bruce Tift. So just to start things off here, I'm curious if you could explain what freedom is.
No. I don't think anybody can explain it. It's pretty classic, I think, that most efforts are pointing efforts because freedom is sort of unconditional freedom anyway, by its nature is without ascribable qualities. It's just openness. And so, different people use different language, or they might use art or poetry or all sorts of things, symbolism, to point toward an experience, but none of those efforts can capture the actual experience. You've heard like the finger pointing at the moon. The finger is very helpful, so we don't just look at the ground, but we shouldn't mistake the pointer for the experience. Some of the language that makes sense to me as language is to talk about the experience of freedom as conscious participation in open awareness. But that's not going to do anything for anybody.
What is conscious participation in open awareness?
Well, the language is that open awareness is said, at least, from a certain view, to be just basic intelligence, awareness that has no ascribable qualities, no conditions to it. It's not constructed. It's not put together. It's just always present. And of course, a lot of spiritual path work is about the potential to increase our conscious participation in what's already the case, rather than finding or creating something new. And so conscious participation would just mean that probably for most people, incrementally and slowly, moment by moment, we train ourselves to tolerate being consciously aware of this open intelligence, this open experiencing that we can never get a hold of. We can't get a hold of it with our senses. We can't get a hold of it with our thoughts. And so it's sort of slippery, you know. And again, it's more like, well, at least in a certain tradition, Vajrayana tradition, it has more to do with relaxing into what is always present rather than creating something or discovering it. Most traditions, spiritual traditions, I think, are probably pointing at very similar experience, but coming from, you know, different language, different religious traditions, different, you know, views. So, yeah, but I think most of them are probably pointing at something that's very central.
Okay. So would you describe this as the fruitional view?
Well, I think the fruitional view is a view, which is by definition, it's relative. You know, all of our language is relative. All of our experience that has form is relative. But some types of relative experience can point out of themselves, and some types of relative experience point toward other relative experience. It's fine, but it's usually not a path of more wakefulness to keep our attention bouncing between different concepts. So a fruitional view is a view which sort of asserts that as we might have more frequent moments of just open awareness, whatever we call that, that the way we engage with our daily experience, our relative experience, shifts, because a lot of meaning, experiential meaning, comes from context. So if the context of, let's say, feeling irritated is just openness, that's actually going to have a different meaning than if the same experience of irritation is in a context of some complaint about the government or my partner or the weather or something like that. So a fruitional point of view is basically working with our relative experiencing. It's not trivializing it or trying to transcend it, but as a practice anyway, continually placing it experientially in the context, the environment of open awareness. So from that point of view, unlike a lot of sort of popular therapy nowadays, it wouldn't make a lot of sense for somebody to say, oh, I have these wounds from my childhood that have to be healed before I can show up in my life.
Could you talk a little bit about this Western therapeutic perspective of having these wounds that we need to heal?
Well, that's the developmental view, at least in the jargon I use. And basically, it's the large majority of Western therapy. There's Western therapies that are different, but most Western therapies are based on the idea that experiences we had when we were very young were very impactful, very important, and the adaptations we made to taking care of ourselves basically became internalized and repetitive processes, repetitive experiences that sort of were repeated over and over again about the best, the smartest way for me to think of myself, to relate to others, sort of become basically structure, character structure, that's carried into adulthood. And so a developmental view is pretty much that these out-of-date efforts to take care of ourselves are not wrong. They're not pathological, at least is the way I would see it. But basically, they're out of date. But because they were internalized, were unconscious, so we didn't have to reinvent the wheel every day growing up, most of us unconsciously are living in important parts of our life as if we're still a child in our family of origin. And so a lot of Western therapy could be understood as bringing our sense of self, our patterns of engagement, our thinking into a more current adult sort of accurate way of experiencing.
How do you see the fruitional view and the developmental view relating or not in your moment-to-moment experience?
Well, my training is Vajrayana Buddhism, which sort of asserts that relative and absolute are inseparable. They're not the same, but they're not different. You know, it's that non-divided sort of view. So I find that a sort of a fruitional view, which is always returning to immediacy from the point of view that we're only living in the present moment ever. So that's the only location in which experience is arising. So it's really the only location in which we can intervene if we want to try to improve the quality of our experiencing. So there's that focus on immediacy. And from that point of view, it doesn't really matter what the history was that gave rise to these patterns. The point is to challenge our unconscious identification with these patterns and return to an investigation about, well, what's actually most accurate right now, which is never resolvable, but, you know, we still give it our best shot with the view that the deeper we go in that investigation, the less evidence we find of any problem, any objectively existing self, things like that. The developmental view looks at patterns over time because these patterns do continue to get triggered and arise. And if we're aware of these patterns, actually it's more likely that we can intervene and bring ourselves on a relative level more into immediate experiencing. And on another level, the more we, let's say, learn to cultivate a adequately accurate, healthy way of engaging with our life, it actually turns out to be easier to go deeper into, from our Western point of view, our vulnerability, from a Buddhist point of view, experience of openness, because our attention tends to get stopped at problems. It's probably an evolutionary biological thing. So if the more that we keep generating the appearance of problems, usually our attention gets stopped with this very basic urgent feeling, I have to resolve this problem before I am more vulnerable, before I go any deeper. So the more we can clean up our characterological issues, the more we can challenge our identification with conditioned history, then it's just probably more straightforward, probably supports an investigation into the nature of openness.
What happens if we fully commit to experiencing the sense of problem without trying to resolve it?
Well, there's no guarantees, of course, but if somebody investigates in the way that makes sense to me, we train our attention to come out of any concept, any interpretation, any story into immediate sensation level experience because that's always happening. And it's in some ways probably a more accurate assessment about whether there's a current problem or threat than my familiar drama or story. So if somebody is willing to go into their sense of problem experientially, not just intellectually, they might first bring their attention out of their story into immediate body-based sensation, like my stomach's all tight, my heart's beating fast, that sort of thing. And upon investigation, I think it's pretty unlikely we're ever going to find any evidence of a problem. We're not even going to find evidence of our favorite identity dramas like guilt or shame or abandonment or anything like that. Those are all interpretations, actually. If you go deeper from a Vajrayana view, we might actually start having more and more moments of a direct experience that none of our experiencing actually has its own essential nature. That all of our experiencing on a relative level is arising out of incredibly complex factors. It's constructed. And so if we start to have some sort of reliable experience that, oh, let's say from a Buddhist point of view, yeah, I have this experience of being a self, but upon investigation, I never find some objectively existing self, then that's very interesting, because then you have to work with the appearance, but you don't take any of it so personally or seriously. And then, of course, that's true of our emotions and relationships and everything else as well. So we're not trivializing our relative experience, but we're investigating the possibility of not taking it so seriously or personally.
Hearing you say that, I have the sense of begin to like fully commit to my experience. There's a sense of like groundlessness. I get that sense you're talking about there being no foundation for a sense of personal self. And then even though there is like, say, disturbance or pain and suffering of sorts, maybe a sense of chronic anxiety, no sense of problem, and then kind of more of a context that feels free, a bit of like pleasure in that, something that feels good.
So then if you wanted, you just consider taking on a attitude, a commitment to practice, because every moment is fresh. We've never been here before. And so any clarity we had a minute ago, there's no sort of achievement. And so from the point of view of immediacy or impermanence, let's say, from a Buddhist view, we consider taking on the attitude that basically I'm practicing engaging with my experience every moment until I die, and give up any fantasy of resolution of my issues, resolution of my human life, resolution of, you know, my favorite problems.
Could you talk a little bit more about this, the deepening of the Vajrayana path as you understand it? So this full commitment to experience that leads to a sense of its fundamental openness and lack of foundation for personal identity, and how that leads to and relates to awakening.
Well, again, it may or may not lead to those things. There's no guarantees. You know, it's like we are drawn to a certain view or certain practices for who knows what reasons. And then if we commit to making that effort, then we see what happens. So it's not like, oh, there's a formula. But having said that, well, I'm not a Buddhist teacher, so this is, you know, just my version. But I would say that a Vajrayana path, as I've experienced it, is for almost everybody a path. It's not some sudden I get bopped on the head and suddenly I'm realized. I mean, anecdotally, that happens out of the blue to some people, but I don't think it's very reliable. So Vajrayana view, I think, is that you start with very foundational practices and gradually, let's say, take such good care of yourself that you start to loosen up chronic self-absorption. And as that happens, we start to become aware of other people, other aspects of ourselves, the world, and start to slowly discover potentially that actually our experience is more satisfying when we aren't adding self-referential commentary to everything. And at a certain point, we might find that it makes sense experientially, not only intellectually, to investigate the nature of open awareness. And so a very simple version of that might be that we might start off by asking, well, what am I aware of right now? Well, I'm aware of my body and my seat. I'm aware of the light on the screen, whatever. But then we might ask, well, what is it that is aware? Not to be answered intellectually. It's just an inquiry, an experiential inquiry, and it has more to do with opening, relaxing our chronic effort to get a hold of things and seeing what arises. It might just arise as a flash at a certain moment, but if that experience of open awareness starts to become more familiar, then we might also start just being curious about investigating, well, what's the nature of this open awareness? And it's this sort of light, subtle relationship between thinking and experiencing, I would say. It's helpful to use our minds, but we don't want to substitute concept for reality. But if we don't think about things, a lot of times we don't sort of penetrate certain unconscious assumptions and beliefs. And on a very basic level, this is not even Vajrayana, this is just basic Buddhism, I find it helpful to commit to a practice of embodied immediacy, meaning I train my attention to return to some curiosity, some investigation. Well, what am I actually experiencing right at this moment? It's the only moment I'm living in. So what am I experiencing? Oh, what am I experiencing? Again, no interpretation, no commentary, no story. Whatever, a few seconds or something like that, and then on with my life. But it's possible that bringing our attention into immediate experience it lays the groundwork, the foundation for some of the more sort of subtle type of practices like the nature of awareness. A developmental view or a Buddhist path view, you know, Hinayana or Theravada and Mahayana type of view, I think is that it's very helpful for practical reasons to investigate our intuition, our experience, that we are repressing certain aspects of our experience. But from a fruitional point of view, the only moment in which we can participate fully is in the present moment. So if you find that you're suppressing some feeling, that's your immediate experience. It's not like, oh, I'm supposed to resolve this and then I'll fully experience things. No, you fully experience your repression. There's nothing wrong with repression. It's a very practical issue, not a moralistic or an ideological issue. So there's a shift from path to fruition, where in the fruitional practices, So it's a shift where we start to investigate and then be curious about and then train ourselves to open to immediate experiencing, which is always in motion. It's not like frozen a moment. There's no such thing as a moment. You know, we're just as open to this endless display as if there's nothing else that we have to accomplish before that's possible. So we open to feeling that we're repressing our experience is just as valid as being aware of what we're repressing. But as a path issue, it's probably very helpful to investigate that.
So there is the opportunity for openness and willingness in experiencing unwillingness and resistance and repression.
Yes, of course. Yeah. If that's what we're experiencing, that's what we're experiencing. So, you know, most of us, of course, tend to unconsciously have this attitude that if only certain things improve, then I can be more intimately engaged with my life, myself, other people. But the only moment we can be intimate with ourselves and others is in this present moment. So that might suggest that it's just as important to be intimate with our limitations as intimate with our more open experiencing. So in certain abstract language, we're shifting from looking at openness at a content level and starting to look at openness as an attitude that we bring to all content, whether it's open or closed, we like it or not. But most people think of openness as opposed to being closed. But if it's unconditional openness, obviously, we're just as open to the feeling of being closed as we are open to the feeling of being open, or it's not unconditional openness. So open awareness is said, you know, again, you can't define it really, but it's said to have no bias, no agenda, no sort of investment in outcome. So awareness is always just open. We're just as open to dying as we are open to being healthy, you know. We're just as open to neurosis as we are open to sanity. Not because we don't like it or whatever. It's just if that's what it is, that's what it is at that moment. You know?
Let's talk about, I think I've got some like quite utilitarian roots where like...
It's good. That's good.
I want to be happy permanently.
Yeah, so that's intelligent.
Right. Yeah. So
yeah. It's more intelligent to realize that's not going to happen.
Uh-huh.
But it's intelligent to want it, you know.
Sure, okay. And so I want like freedom to whatever extent that's possible. And I think there's like some sense, I think I have some belief in which I'm like, so this is unreliable, I know, but like, even when there's like contraction or resistance or unwillingness, there's like, if one is committing to like full experience, committing to the full experiential intensity of chronic anxiety or fundamental groundlessness or any of these things that we organize our lives around avoiding, that like, I seem to have some belief that like, then the context will always be that sort of like loving joyous playfulness.
No, that's but, a nice belief.
Thank you.
Some people believe in heaven.
Some people believe in heaven. Right.
Right.
There is, though, in spiritual traditions, the discussion of nirvana, or in Christianity, the kingdom of heaven is on earth. So some people believe in heaven, some people believe in enlightenment.
Well, belief is a substitute. I mean, somebody could have a sophisticated relationship with belief, but most people a belief is a substitute for groundlessness, you know, for openness. I want some assurance about how things are going to go. You know?
Yeah, there's no assurance of how things are going to go.
Yeah, it's just an effort to give form to immediate openness. It's not really about the future. You have no way of knowing that these practices that you're interested in are going to give you the result you would like. You can't know that. But if we haven't trained ourselves to live with uncertainty or not knowing, whatever we call it, then of course it's very tempting to generate a reference point of saying, oh, okay, if I do this, then I'll get what I want. Of course, it's very human. Yeah.
I feel like more love and playfulness hearing that. And it makes the belief say like, oh yeah, see, here we go. Like the less you know, then like, see, it's working. You seem to go all the way. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. And then
no guarantee.
If it makes sense, you appreciate that momentary experience. And then if you want, bring your attention out of any story into immediate experiencing. And you can use sensations as a anchor. It's not the answer. It's just sensation. It's hard to find a story in sensations. Stories require concepts. So part of our path work is to train ourselves to come out of our identification with concepts. And it's just a practical way to do it, to bring our attention to sensations. But you're not going to find a sensation of achievement. That's not a sensation.
It's interpretation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's okay as an interpretation, but if we don't train ourselves to stay in that groundless, vulnerable experience, and we don't really stay in it, most of our practices are recovery practices for the indefinite future. We train ourselves to return to openness, groundlessness, vulnerability, which is more disturbing, of course, than training ourselves to return to the breath. That's sort of a more neutral, safe thing to do. But the more we return to what we find to be most fundamental in the present moment, we're just stepping out of the drama. We're not solving it. So we don't have to solve our beliefs. The point is to challenge our tendency to be identified with them.
So I was feeling like very, very happy. And then I got angry and then I felt contracted.
Yeah, that's good to be aware of.
And I was also noticing how I think Adyashanti has this quote that I really like. He said something like, most people know not to get caught in hell, but most people don't know not to get caught in heaven. So what you're saying felt a lot like that.
Yeah, I like him a lot. Yeah. It's you know, almost by definition, openness is without bias. And so when we're ready, we apply that to positive experience as well as negative, but almost anybody, of course, is going to start with the effort to get out of suffering, out of negative experience, of course. And until we gain a certain type of experience, unconsciously, we think that the antidote to negative experience is positive experience. It doesn't occur to us that maybe it's just open, non-biased, sort of immediate engagement, you know. That comes down the road probably. But nothing wrong with starting off by trying to get out of negative experience. Why would we do something so stupid as spiritual practice if that weren't our initial investment?
Yeah. Why would we do that?
Better to go have an ice cream or, you know, see a movie or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I could move on to another question, but I'm also enjoying where we're at right now.
Yeah, and if you wanted to, like if I'm working with somebody, I might invite them, you could do it or not, to just say out loud something like, I give myself permission to never experience what I most want in this life. So if you care to, you could just say that out loud and see what comes up.
Okay, I'll probably get really angry. I give myself experience. Oh, hold up. I give myself permission to not experience what I most want in this life.
Yeah. And just maybe just stop and see what energy arises. No story, no drama. And then if you check it out as immediate experience, where's the problem? Where's this, you know, drama about whether I'm going to get what I want or not?
Well, actually, I can notice it. There's a lot of objections, right, from the committee upstairs.
Right.
What the hell is he talking about? Like, there's this kind of like, this like childish utilitarian thing where like life, it's like this egoic perspective about life is about me as like a local self extracting as much positive experience out of this universe as possible before I die.
Yeah, well, that's very intelligent. And it's very probably biological too. So, you know, maybe let's say
intelligent.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, why would somebody do spiritual practice unless it's just a more subtle version of the same thing?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, we put a we spiritualize that same call.
Yeah. And if a spiritual path is effective, in my opinion, for somebody, it's a process that actually undermines its own apparent reality and foundation. And leaves us progressively in this just open, immediate experiencing. But why would we, as we were just saying, why would we make all this effort if it wasn't to try to have the most meaningful, satisfying life possible? But at some point, a certain paradoxical understanding arises about, oh, well, this is a little weird, but maybe for me to move forward beyond this point, I'm going to have to give up my agendas of moving forward.
So, like, I keep feeling better hearing some of what you're saying, but then you're really good at, like, deflating that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you're really good at deflating that by challenging me, by saying, like, okay, that's not an achievement, like, it's not an accomplishment, like, okay, that's true right now, but there's no ground for that. Right. And you keep saying that, and I keep feeling better, and but then I get angry, and I feel some like resistance, and
that sounds like accurate. Yeah.
So I mean, it is paradoxical, and like
it's not paradoxical. Actually, it's the way our dualistic minds work that make it appear to be a paradox. But reality, I don't think is paradoxical. It's just, when our dualistic minds engage with non-divided reality, you know, that's how we think about it.
What is non-divided reality?
That's just some language to suggest that we are the universe experiencing itself, we're life experiencing itself, and we're a rather unique, as far as we know, expression of life, the universe, where there's this very interesting capacity for self-reflexive awareness. And so we're always, you know, have this impulse to try to make ourselves the object of our experiencing, sort of. And there's some benefits to that, and there's some price tags. But if we get out of our identification with our thinking, let's say you go for a walk or you're riding a bicycle down a hill or something, surfing in the ocean, you probably don't experience paradox. You know, you're just participating rather fully. There's no evidence of a division anywhere between you and the rest of your life. There's no evidence of discontinuity that I've ever found. The sense of discontinuity comes from our identification with pretending to be a separate, alienated self. But that's what we have to work with. You know, we don't make it wrong. You know, we practice being kind and investigating it.
I'm curious about how we commit to what it means to commit to full experiential intensity in this present moment. And then these sorts of, you know, ways in which you challenge me, and I assume also your clients, around, okay, like, give up any hope that, like, what you most want in life is going to happen, or, like, stop, like...
That's a... Yeah, that's a classic Vajrayana sort of thing. Give up all hope of fruition, you know, when people go on long retreats or something.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's good. I mean, yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's good guideline, you know, advice. It's just an invitation to return to immediacy, basically. Instead of projecting aspects of our experience into some fantasized future.
It really sneaks in the back door, the way that the sense of, like, problem, okay?
Yes.
Okay, I need to resolve this, then I'll be okay.
Sure. Yeah, that's what we have to work with, yeah. So again, we don't solve that aspect of being human, perhaps as much as just step out of it into immediate experience. And in immediate experiencing, there's a lot of layers that we gradually can investigate. Perhaps discovering again that we may never find any evidence of essential nature for ourselves, our feelings, our experience, anything. It doesn't mean everything's illusory. I don't happen to like that particular take on things, but, you know, some people find that helpful. But it just means its appearance, but it doesn't mean that there's some objective existence that appearance is an expression of. So that includes our sense of problem. You realize, oh, I have this idea that it's a problem that I'm always generating problems. And then if you happen to think of it, you just say, oh, what am I actually experiencing right at this moment? No interpretations, no concepts, no stories. You're not going to find paradox. You're not going to find problems. You're not going to find anything wrong with you. You're just going to find, oh, my stomach's tight, or I feel numb, or my throat's constricted, or so what, you know?
I think I'm noticing that my addiction to making a problem out of the fact that I create problems is a way of avoiding my terror at not having control of my experience.
Yeah, it's a good way of saying it, probably, yeah. Or panic around an intuitive glimpse of openness, groundlessness, yeah.
Yeah, there's like a part that's like screaming about this thing that's going on, that level of openness.
Freedom apparently is not synonymous with positive feelings.
What does it mean for freedom not to be synonymous with positive feelings?
Well, as we were mentioning earlier, unconditional freedom, almost by definition, has to be available, intimate with any experience. And obviously, our human experience is not just positive. We're sensitive biological life forms. We're going to die. There's always going to be pain and difficult emotions that arise. So if we, again, want to shift toward openness as an attitude rather than openness as an experience, then our attitude has to be open toward anything and everything, rather than thinking that openness is synonymous with feeling calm and peaceful and expansive and, you know, equanimous and blah, 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 you know? I mean, on a relative level, obviously health is not synonymous with positive feelings. We never go to a doctor because it's not fun. We never get a shot. We never do things that are difficult, maybe like exercise or whatever, if it wasn't positive. So, no, again, it's just a very, I think, evolutionary, biological part of our hardwiring that probably for evolutionary reasons, our ancestors that went for positive experience and avoided negative experience turned out to be our ancestors. The ones who didn't probably got eaten up, you know. We're very powerfully conditioned on many levels, energetic, biological, evolutionary, emotional, cultural, personal. We're very conditioned to escape from vulnerability and openness. So we can make a commitment to voluntarily take our attention back into openness, into vulnerability, but it's not easy. You know, my current sort of language that I prefer as far as talking about vulnerability is just formless panic. And nobody wants to hang out in formless panic. I don't, you know, you don't, nobody wants to. So it has to be a discipline, and a discipline requires effort. That's all path. You know, it's not the fruitional view, it's path view. And, you know, obviously a lot of spiritual practices also have a path quality. But a Western path in therapy has a lot to do with looking at the influences of our young experience, and not many spiritual traditions pay any attention to what it must have been like as young, powerless children. You know?
I think there's a way in which it's really easy. I mean, it's, I think, easy. I've thought it had been easy to bring this kind of mirror-like quality to awareness. But I actually think it was like very quite rigid and like holding itself back in meaningful ways.
Well, you should just count on that. Yeah. A Buddhist view about relative experience, as I understand it, would be that we should just count on all of our experiencing having both sane and neurotic components that will always be entangled with each other. So we start training ourselves to give up either or, all or nothing, black or white thinking and organization, and instead assume that anything I experience will probably have a sane component, which I appreciate and strengthen, maybe, and it will also have a neurotic component, which I can challenge.
You have a quote from your book that I like, that's, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering.
Well, that actually was Carl Jung's quote, the one that I offered that made sense to me was that neurosis is always a substitute for experiential intensity, because I think we also avoid extreme joy and power and sexuality and openness as well, not just negative things. Again, in Vajrayana, there's absolute, which perhaps is just that open intelligence, that open, immediate, intimate presence. And then there's relative reality. And within relative reality, there's relatively accurate experiencing and relatively inaccurate or false experiencing. And so as a path issue, of course, we want to challenge false relative experience and have more accurate relative experience. It just supports our investigation of the possibility that openness is always present, it's always available. But again, if we think our survival is being threatened, if there's a big problem, our attention tends to contract. You know, like I might have said in the book, if you're out hiking in the woods and you're enjoying an expansive experience, listening to the birds and looking at the sky and everything, and you come around a corner and there's a bear there, your attention is not going to remain expansive. It's going to get very focused and contractive, and you're going to, you know, run or whatever you think you're going to do. So every time that we claim that our survival is threatened, even somewhat unconsciously, every time we claim that we are a problem, or there is this wound, or there's something about me that's inherently unworthy of love, or all those things that are worked with in therapy, we actually tend to contract our attention. So it's just a practical issue that's very smart, I think, to work on our relative experience, our characterological issues, our historic conditioning, as a way to support a more relaxed attention. That's not the same as awareness. It's just facilitates an investigation of awareness.
How does it facilitate an investigation of awareness?
Well, let's say you went to a party and there was somebody who either you really had trouble with or somebody you were really attracted to. You would probably not be so aware of your environment, of other people. Your attention would really probably be very focused on that person, either avoiding them or trying to connect with them. And so it's not wrong, it's fine, but you're probably going to get less information about other people and the energy of the room and the physical environment and, you know, whether it's time to for you to, you know, leave or not, or, you know, whatever.
Do you have any more of these statements that you like to share with, I don't know, clients or in your teachings, like the that Vajrayana one about giving up any hope of ever achieving, what was it, fruition?
Yeah, giving up all hope of fruition, yeah. Well, there's another quote that I happen to like by Trungpa Rinpoche in the book, I think, which was the bad news is that we're falling through the air without a parachute. The good news is there's no ground. So that, I sort of enjoy that one. But I tend not to try to inflict people I'm working with a lot of Buddhist sayings.
Well, you're welcome to share them here if you'd like.
Yeah, no, I don't have a repertoire of them.
Okay. I really like that. It seems so valuable to be giving up things like hope.
Well, we don't want to give up hope, perhaps. We're challenging our identification with hope. Basically, we're giving up, as a practice, our identification with any and all experiencing. Doesn't matter. Positive, negative, spiritual, daily, you know.
How does one give up identification with all content of awareness?
Well, again, it has, for most of us, it's going to have to be a practice, and a practice that I find and some people find helpful is to step out of concept into immediate embodied sensation level experience, because in immediate embodied experiencing, you don't find really anything to identify with unless you're using concepts. So you might find your stomach's knotted up, and then your mind says, oh gosh, I wonder why my mind's knotted up. What does this mean? Well, we're in concepts. So if we realize that, whoops, okay, just back to sensation. I'm not solving anything. I'm not trying to understand it. I'm not trying to heal it. I'm not trying to process it. I'm just keeping it company. And so I find it's most helpful to step out of our very powerful tendency toward identification rather than think we're going to solve them, because usually we're trying to solve them with other concepts. Same principle as meditation. Somebody is off in their fantasy, their absorbed state of mind, and they realize, well, you know, and then they bring their attention back usually to some immediate embodied experiencing, often something like the breath or some visual object or something. And then they're gone. Then they come back. Then they leave. They come back. They leave. They come back. It's a practice, maybe till we die. But anecdotally, people who make that effort usually report that they wake up out of unconscious absorbed states of mind more and more frequently. And that's a lot of our work is to just increase the frequency of bringing our experience into open, immediate, embodied presence. Then we're just winging it at that point, which we're doing anyway.
In your book, you describe a significant shift that happened for you that seemed to lead to a lot more freedom. Would you like to share or explain what that was?
Well, it's been a while, so I'll just be making it up, but it wasn't some sort of immediate sort of earth-shaking experience like some people report. For me, it was more gradual. Things just were shifting away from being so unconsciously fascinated with what I was experiencing toward more frequent moments of being aware of and curious about how I was relating to what I was experiencing. And the shift, for me anyway, was not that something really cosmically different happened. It's more like from my familiar ground of feeling like somehow I was a problem, life was a problem, and then I'd have moments of clarity, moments of feeling more freedom, more moments of open-heartedness, whatever, but then I'd be back into some more self-referential drama. Something at some point shifted where the ground started to be experienced as just immediate open workability, and out of that ground of open workability, moments of problems, neurosis, drama would continue to rise. But then spontaneously, my attention would come back more to the ground. So the language that made sense to me was thinking of it as a shift in my experiential center of gravity, where what I was experiencing didn't change as much as the center of gravity that my attention would just organically keep returning to.
To a full commitment to experiential intensity.
Well, that's a practice. I wouldn't say I'm fully committed to experiential intensity, but at this point I'm fully committed to being who I am, which is not to be fully committed to experiential intensity. I don't have an agenda that I'm supposed to be other than I am. I'm a profoundly limited person,
Let's talk about being profoundly limited people.
Okay.
I think there are like moments of clarity, like even throughout this interview, where I'm very present. And like committed to experiencing, even the things which I tend to avoid. But there's something like sticky about this, like sense of problem, the way that it like reasserts itself.
Yeah. Well, just count on it. Yeah.
It's so great hearing you say things like that, because part of me wants is ready for the solution.
But well, that's the part of you that is still refusing to be intimate with yourself. As if who you are in all your limitations, as if you as a messy, confused human are somehow not okay. As if there's something inadequate about who you are by being a profoundly limited, human. So all of our fantasies of self-improvement, if we're taking them seriously, are basically expressions of aggression toward our own self. Which again, that aggression has no essential nature, so it's not inherently a problem, but if we're identified with our experience, then it's something we should work with. If you wanted, you could try another sentence. You could say, I give myself permission to be a profoundly limited person who will never do everything that's would be helpful for me to do.
Okay, I give myself permission to be a profoundly limited person who will not do all of the things that I would like myself to do.
Yeah, or that would probably be helpful for me to do.
Or that would be helpful for me to do.
Yeah, you're not going to have enough time and energy to do everything that's helpful. You're going to just choose some things for reasons you don't even know. And everything else, you'll just remain very limited. And you'll have some improvement in the things you put effort into. But you're never going to not be a profoundly limited person, in my opinion, not just you, all of us. But so what? Why do we think it's supposed to be otherwise?
Yeah, I'm getting very, very strong objection from a particular part.
Yeah, so if you want, then you could say out loud also, I give myself permission to pretend to be a problem and postpone unconditional kindness to myself. Yeah, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Well, you're giving yourself permission. It doesn't mean you don't know what you're going to do even from now. It's a way of addressing your fantasy of being in a state of struggle with yourself in the present.
Yeah, I mean, what's coming up for me again is just like the ways in which all this drama is again like very sophisticated ways of avoiding very obvious truths.
Again, that's not really about the future. That's about reducing your fantasy of being divided against yourself in a state of struggle with yourself.
There's like this, there's like this global permission giving.
That, yes.
Yeah, I'm noticing.
Yeah, some people just suggest the practice of using yes as a way of engaging with all of our experiencing without exception. It doesn't mean yes on a behavioral level. It means yes on an experiential level. And we say yes because it's there. We don't say yes because we like it or not.
One of these excellent permission statements you gave earlier was to give yourself the permission to never have or experience what you most want in life. One part of your book is also about asking yourself what it is that you most want in life and seeing if it's not already available right now.
Well, yes, that would be good. And on a path level, on a relative level, I think it's helpful to ask what we most want, what our highest priorities are, what our intentions are, what's, you know, because as we were just talking about, we're profoundly limited, and on a relative form level, nobody can do everything. That would be interesting or helpful or whatever. So the more that we can clarify what our highest priorities are, then potentially the more we can bring our behavior, our thinking, our emotional process, our spiritual practices into alignment with that priority. And it's more likely if we give it more attention and energy, we'll make more progress in that direction. But as soon as we're willing to clarify our highest priority, then we are sort of forced to take responsibility for what we're choosing not to get, even though that also is important to us. It just turns out to be not as important. So everything we get is inseparable from loss and limitation. And we don't like that. Most of us want everything that's important. So then we pretend to be confused or in a state of struggle or paralyzed or whatever our thing is.
Does centerlessness or say one taste from Dzogchen or non-dual awareness come into this for you?
Yeah, that's sort of another pointing, I think, toward what could be called non-dual or non-divided. It's like as somebody shifts their experiential center of gravity from what they're experiencing to their awareness of what they're experiencing, everything starts to actually sort of feel like the same. It's not because red looks like blue, it doesn't turn all mushy. It's just that the awareness, which is the primary experiencing, is always the same. Awareness doesn't change. Awareness doesn't have a bias. Awareness doesn't care if it's red or blue. So there's always that presence. And I think it's that open, aware presence that gives rise to the what people call one taste. It's not like vanilla starts tasting like chocolate. No, that's not the point.
During that, I was noticing the experience of like having like fully committed to the present moment. It almost felt like each moment was like eating itself. It's like a sense of impermanence that I hadn't ever noticed before.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of saying it. There isn't such a thing as a moment, as far as I know. It's an analog. It's not digital as far as experience. And so different people use different language, but one is that all of our experiencing is this endless display of stream of experiencing where always something is arising out of mystery. It's there for a little while, apparently, and then it dissolves away again. And as something dissolves away, something else is arising. So there's never any moment when there's not this display arising. I mean, some people report that they go into trance states where there's formlessness, but that certainly is possible. But I think a trance state is probably not the best guideline for dealing with our human experiencing if somebody's interested in that. So I think we should just count on there always being this endless display of experience, which we want to be aware of, work with, make choices about, say yes or no to on a relative level, and simultaneously at all times, at least practice an attitude of non-bias, of holding in the environment of openness, of freedom, whatever it is that's arising. So saying that your experience is eating itself is a fine way to say it. But then you could be curious about what is it that I'm claiming is doing the eating.
Instead of the sense of there being kind of like an analog continuity between each moment, it was like kind of more like the sense that it was, I don't know, each moment was being like destroyed.
Yeah, that's a legitimate way of saying it. I don't think it's accurate that it's being destroyed. I think it's, you know, in Buddhist jargon, they talk about dependent origination, meaning that everything that arises in our experience is arising out of all these complex factors, and we're never going to be aware of all of these many, many entangled factors. And so it's the only way something could be destroyed is if it had an actual existence. And so that's fine. You know, it's good to approach it in ways that make sense to us. That's our path. You know, we don't want to substitute some ideology for our actual immediate experience. But from a certain point of view, if there isn't a thing, then there's nothing to be destroyed.
Shinzen Young has this think this story he talks about of someone in Japanese TV who was asked what enlightenment was, and I think the Zen guy who was answering the question, he said something like, enlightenment is the cessation of making a distinction between enlightenment and non-enlightenment. And so I think I was noticing some clarification of that in the giving permission to be, quote, say, deluded or ignorant or limited or unenlightened.
Uh-huh. And, you know, who knows, you know, when you're talking in an interview or TV, you know, you have to use a certain level of language, but I don't think there is such a thing as enlightenment, personally. And we could say that, yes, one way of pointing at this open experience is that we don't take our discriminating awareness as being about different things that have their own essential nature. The things are there as appearances, but not as objective existence. And so from that point of view, some people might think, oh, well, I shouldn't be making any distinctions between deluded experience and wakeful experience. Well, that's obviously not very intelligent on a relative path level. It is accurate from an absolute point of view. But if somebody sees absolute and relative as inseparable, more of a non-dual approach, then we don't take at least too seriously our efforts to define things in terms of it's this and it's not that. We have to use that language, but we don't take it maybe too seriously. It's, again, it's just pointing in a direction for us to investigate experientially. But we don't know, you know, who knows what enlightenment is. I think it's actually very rare, as far as I can tell. I don't think of myself as an enlightened person. So, you know, if we start to speculate about enlightenment, well, that's what it is. It's speculation, which is okay. It could be interesting or provide a certain sort of direction. But I don't think we should take our speculations too seriously because we don't know, you know. If you wanted to travel to India or something, it would be great to do some research, watch some videos, do some reading, you know, make plans. But you shouldn't maybe think that any of that experience you're having of preparing is going to be the same as when you're there. It's impossible.
I don't think I have the full quote here, but there's this part of your book that caught my attention where you said that something along the lines of trying to have the experience of no self is still motivated fundamentally by probably a fundamental aggression towards experience.
Well, it doesn't have to be, but I think that's a possibility that somebody who thinks in those terms might be aware of, that I think that it's very easy when people talk about no self that they actually have this idea that their experience of self should be extinguished somehow. Maybe I don't agree with that approach because, like I said, a Vajrayana approach is more about the transparency of relative experience rather than getting rid of it. So instead of no self, what makes sense to me is more transparency in our experiencing of self, or in Vajrayana jargon, we could say appearance emptiness, meaning the appearance is there, and simultaneously there's some increasing confidence of no essential nature, no objective existence, with that appearance. So it's vivid appearance, and that's what we have to work with. But I think, you know, some spiritual practitioners have this idea that somehow the ego is bad and they're supposed to conquer the ego or get rid of the ego or get rid of the sense of self. And, you know, I'm sure there are versions of that that support some path of liberation, but I think, let's just say it doesn't resonate for me.
I'm just going to share some more parts of your book here that I particularly liked. We create a sense of center by organizing our life around avoiding things which we're fundamentally aggressive to, and then experience ourselves or life as a problem through our own continued resistance to experiencing what the ego exists off of being in resistance to. So this is a paraphrase. Some of this is my own language, but...
Sure.
The sense of like maintaining a center through the belief in the problem making seems very... like a core part of maintaining the experience of self.
Yeah, on a sort of a relative level. It's not a subtle level, really, but a relative level. It's like you've mentioned a couple of times that when certain, let's say, vulnerability or openness has been touched for you, that anger has arisen. We don't know each other, but my fantasy would be that anger perhaps is not one of your favorite feelings. And so if you do have some tendency to organize your sense of self, your behavior, your emotional experience, your relating with other people to try to not be angry, you know, to be a kind, compassionate, generous person, yeah, which a lot of people do, then it's very likely that avoiding being just as open to anger as we are open to being kind is an unconscious way of continuing to invest in that anger as if it's especially real and important. Otherwise, we wouldn't need to avoid it. And so let's say somebody may or may not be relevant for you, but let's say somebody has a history where they grew up learning that it wasn't smart to show anger. And so you can't be a human without anger, you know. You don't have to do anything about it, but you can't be a life form probably without aggressive energy. So every time that we engage with ourselves and with others, with life, to avoid anger, we're actually placing anger at the center of our experiential organization at that moment. And over decades, over time, actually, somebody might realize, actually, the very feeling that I claim I'm trying to stay away from, I've put at the center of my sense of self. And I have this conviction that it's bad. And so now, unfortunately, I have this feeling that somehow I'm bad. It's sort of vague, it's sort of unconscious, but I have this bad stuff, these bad feelings that keep on getting triggered, and I don't know what to do with them. It's not okay to be that way. I have to heal them. I have to meditate them away or something. Actually, that organization suggests to me, as a therapist anyway, that actually that person is maintaining their fascination with an investment in exactly that energy because they're making it sort of the most important feeling in their life.
Could you talk about how this grasping and say resistance and how neuroses, can you explain their function in our lives and what it is that they are attempts at obscuring?
Well, nobody has an answer to that. So, you know, I have opinions. One of my opinions is that I don't think it's helpful from a path point of view, if somebody's interested in waking up or personal growth, to think of neurosis as pathological or as obscuring something so much. My preference would be to think of it as an out-of-date effort to take the best care of ourselves possible from a Western point of view, a therapy view, or our efforts to generate the appearance of reference point or identity or some structure from a Buddhist point of view, or our efforts to give form to space or openness. So from that point of view, it's not like a problem. It just doesn't work very well because neither is accurate. We don't get rid of our vulnerabilities by avoiding them, and we don't make openness go away by generating a fantasy of form and structure. But on a more relative level, it seems to me that the function of neurosis is to do our best to not have to experience, especially emotions, but any sort of experience that feels dangerous or overwhelming or scary or too much or anything like that. And so in a very simplistic way, we could just say that from a therapy point of view, neurosis seems to be organized around avoiding immediate experience of vulnerability. I think the language that makes sense to me as far as vulnerability is just that of formless panic. And nobody wants to experience formless panic that I know of, so it makes sense that we would try to avoid it. It's just that, is the price tag of that avoidance worth the benefit? If we're living out in the woods 100,000 years ago, yeah, probably better safe than sorry. You hear a noise in the bush, probably better to get ready to run or fight than to just investigate your emotional reactivity and vulnerability. But, you know, for quite a while, most of us are living more in a social reality where probably 99% of the moments in which our sort of experience of threat gets triggered, probably almost always that's not an accurate signal that our survival is actually at risk. So we might choose to train ourselves to stay embodied with that panic, let it have its own sort of wave-like life of its own, and see for ourselves, where's the problem? Is there a problem? Is there a threat? So it's sort of like, you know, addictions could be understood as a sort of a one extreme example of neurosis in general, which is an effort to avoid feeling threatened, feeling panic. And that's not wrong. It's just that if there isn't any real threat there, then we're going to not be very skillful in how we engage with ourselves, our emotions, other people, life in general.
What's coming up for me is there's that sense that, say, neuroses or resistance as a strategy of best taking care of ourselves is not a problem, right? And so there's this truth that there's an option not to make any experience a problem.
And then that's a theoretical option. Most of us don't really have that as an actual experiential option. So that's why it has to be a practice for most of us.
Right. Is there a significant, what's coming up for me is the sense of like there also being a significant difference between the suffering of neurosis and resistance and then the pain and freedom of being committed to open awareness?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've heard the slogan that has been floating around a number of years, that pain is part of life and suffering is optional. Yeah, that's sort of maybe what you're pointing at, that we don't get a human life without pain, without fundamental emotional intensity like fear and anxiety and grief and rage, most of us, you know. And most people find those experiences difficult, and that's accurate. You know, it's accurate that your body's going to signal what we experience as pain if you cut yourself or get a broken bone or something like that. We don't want to deny that, maybe, but unnecessary suffering could be understood as the effort to not fully be aware of, stay embodied with, participate in, be open-hearted to that actual pain. So it's understandable we want to avoid pain and try to pull in what's positive. But if we take that probably evolutionary impulse as if it's the way to live one's life, it's almost inevitable that we're going to be generating unnecessary suffering that comes from the fact that none of those avoidance strategies make our human vulnerability go away. By avoiding them, we aren't training ourselves or teaching ourselves, learning how to deal with what's difficult. And those avoidance strategies almost always have their own unnecessary price tag, because they're not based on what's true. They're not effective, actually, except for short-term immediate relief. And so if somebody would like less unnecessary suffering, unfortunately or not, the antidotal practice is a commitment to whatever arises endlessly as the truth of our experiencing.
What are the different facets of how the truth of our own experiencing is disturbing, or so disturbing that commitment to neuroses or resistance would seem to be a strategy that many of us choose?
Well, you were joking before about investigating feeling like a selfish person. How would it feel to welcome feeling like a perpetrator, feeling like somebody who's actually harming others and is going to just treat others as objects? And that, would that be okay for you, just to stay embodied with that experience?
I try my best.
Head yes?
I try my best.
Why would you have to try?
Because it's disturbing.
Yeah. So if you want, then you can investigate that experience of disturbance and you'll get better information than my theories. But as a theory, let's say you're hanging off a cliff and, you know, you're hanging on for dear life and somebody's up there telling you to, hey, there's no problem, just let go, you know.
You should meditate.
You should meditate. Yeah, be like me. I don't have any problems. And that, you know, they give you a lot of theories about why that might be so. You're going to feel some panic. And it's possible, just giving an analogy, that if finally either you decide to let go or your fingers get so tired or somebody comes and pries them off the cliff and you start falling, you're going to feel panic. And maybe it turns out that the ground was just a foot below you, but you hadn't ever really looked at it because it's scary. And it turns out, oh, actually, that was scary, but no harm. I didn't die. But that doesn't make the anticipatory anxiety and the panic of openness go away. We have to go through that type of experience thousands of times to start, let's say, building, generating new neural pathways besides our evolutionary hardwiring.
What is that ground that is a foot away?
It's just that our drama of being an alienated significant self turns out to have no essential nature to it. It's like, I forget if we had mentioned one of Trungpa Rinpoche's quotes, which I like earlier. I'll say it again in case not, but that the bad news is we're falling through the air without a parachute, and the good news is there's no ground. So more precisely, what we discover is there's no ground, and it's not killing us. We're just falling through space until we don't.
Is that facet that there is no ground one of the items that's disturbing to us in a way that we seek to avoid? So there's like the sense of being committed to one's experience leads to confronting the limitation of the contents of experience. So biology and gender and life circumstance. And then there is that sense of emptiness that you're also speaking to. So I'm curious if that is another truth that resistance and neuroses serves as a way of avoiding recognition of.
Sure. There's a lot of ways of pointing toward what can't be captured in language or even symbols or anything. You had asked a little earlier about resistance or grasping, so that I think in some traditions, the idea is that it's not a good idea to grasp at material objects or positive emotions, things like that, or relationships or whatever. But I think more accurately for me, the point is that grasping or resistance is the function itself. It's not the object that matters. If I hold up my hand and make a fist, I'm going to have probably an idea that I'm holding on to something. But if I start to open it up at some point and there's nothing there, I might realize it was the grasping itself that was the function. It's the resistance itself. It's not resistance to anything. Because grasping or resistance, contraction, generates an experience of solidity, which is sort of the antidote unconsciously to openness. It's not really, but it seems that way.
It would also seem to solidify the ground which you're about to hit.
Yeah, well, that's our imagination, of course. I mean, if we hit it, we hit it. If we don't, we don't. But when I'm hanging off the cliff, my real experience is just understandably sort of evolutionary panic, vulnerability. Oh, I could die, this is dangerous, whatever gets activated, because I think, I can't prove anything, but I think probably every cell in our body carries the non-conceptual information that there's no permanent life, that it's just when we get wiped out or harmed or damaged or hurt or scared or something. So anytime there's openness, there's always openness, anytime we consciously participate in a moment of openness, there's this panic, but the panic isn't about hitting the ground. The panic is that our fantasy of being a significant, real, objectively existing self with its own essential nature is actually accurate. And then, of course, when our familiar forms are challenged through life circumstances or meditation or anything, it's very probably inevitable that we'll just try to come up with some new forms. Now we use spiritual, you know, sort of identity instead of my old social identity or something like that. But it's all the same impulse, maybe.
I'm curious how that fundamental and essential ground of groundlessness, how that fits into the picture of freedom and nirvana, if you want to use that word.
Well, what do you think?
I think you probably, well, what I think about what you would think.
No, what do you think? Anything you think is what you think, even if you claim it's about what I think.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. What do I think? It seems like a kind of like a metaphysical kind of freedom that you can have access to any time that you recognize it. But I feel contracted saying this, so it's probably untrue, but I'm just going to bring it to the light for the sake of clarification. Since we get born and we seem to forget the groundless ground, like the suffering comes back. Maybe this has to do with adolescence. But as we practice and gain more knowledge, we seem to gain that back. So it's like the freedom's always there. It's always available, but it seems like emptiness likes to forget itself.
Well, that's a valid way of talking. Do you know that any of those ideas you have are accurate?
I I don't know that. I try to listen to my body, and what my body says is feels true.
And do you know that what you listen to is accurate?
What I said is accurate?
What you said, what you think, what you sense.
I guess I don't. I mean, I don't know that I know. You can't know that you know, but sometimes I know.
Well, so if you know that you know, then if you examine that in the next moment, you can't be sure that that was accurate. So it's possible that what's most true is that you don't know. You have theories, which, you know, are congruent with a lot of spiritual path theories, but you don't really know if any of them are accurate or even useful, probably. So what would that be like to rest in that not knowing instead of think, oh, I have to figure this out?
This isn't true, but I'm going to say it again for clarification. I think this is just me getting interested in my mind. My mind is like, well, you know, that's kind of a sleight of hand because, like, it seems like we can know that we don't know. And that's a kind of knowing, and that just, you know, it deepens the commitment to immediate experiencing of uncertainty and groundlessness, which kind of still fits into the theory of, like, that being freedom, but it's doing that by negating itself kind of underhandedly.
Well, that's a good trick, you know, and it's like Madhyamaka in Vajrayana Buddhism uses logic to point out that there's no logical way to take a position about anything. But we use that logic, but the point is not to take it as if the ideas or the words or the theories are the point. You know, it's like the finger pointing at the moon. It's helpful to have the finger, or we might never look up, but we don't want to mistake the finger for the moon, just to use that classic example. So it's great to have our theories, and they're very helpful as pointers or as direction or sort of to nudge our intuition a little bit, maybe. But, you know, we shouldn't maybe take any theories, including Buddhism, you know, too seriously, in my opinion, including what I just said. We shouldn't take that too seriously also.
Do you take seriously the thought to not take anything seriously?
Well, same thing. Appreciate the usefulness of the thought, and I don't believe I sort of have any sort of territory staked out on it as a reference point. If I get hungry, it's fine for me to go look for some food to eat, but I don't take that hunger as some sort of permanent position. You know, all of our relative experience arises out of countlessly complex factors, and we're never going to be in touch with even a small minority of those factors, I think. So, you know, all of our language or thinking is sort of a type of shorthand. That's why we want to be clear about our priorities so that we have a better chance of using these tools, the tools of concepts and theories, in support of what we believe to be most important. Because nobody has enough time and energy to do everything that's important. So if it's helpful for you to really be curious about how to use your mind to help release your identification with your mind, that, I would say, is helpful from a path point of view.
The title of your book is Already Free.
Right.
What does it mean to say already free?
Well, again, as an analogy, let's say you grew up in financial poverty. Your family was poor. You had to have a lot of anxiety as part of your environment about whether you're going to be able to pay the rent or have food or medicine and stuff like that. And that's just part of your hard wiring now, or at least your conditioned history. And then somewhere you're an adult and you're lucky, you win the lottery, or you're smart and you get in on a good investment, and now you have, you know, plenty of money in your account. So you don't probably, you know, you don't know, but probably you don't have to worry about money anymore for the rest of your life. But you have that conditioned history where you find yourself at the grocery store comparing different brands so you can save 29 cents. And you worry about, you know, how much the gas is, and you go out of your way to pay a little less, and you worry about, you know, some bill that's coming in. That's just the way we work. So at some point, off and on, you might spontaneously, or somebody might help you, or you might just take it on as a practice to remind yourself, oh, wait a minute, I already have enough money. But I should expect to keep on going into my anxiety about scarcity off and on, pretty much until I die, because it's such a powerful conditioning. But anytime I actually think about it and stop and check my bank account, there isn't actually a realistic cause of panic. So that's, of course, just an analogy. But when somebody starts to have moments of conscious participation and open awareness, it's possible that there is an actual experience that's not a conceptual experience, it's not a theory, of deep openness, relief, relaxation, expansiveness, confidence, clarity, you know, whatever words we use. And if somebody finds some variety of ways to keep bringing their curiosity, their attention back into that inquiry, and starts to have more and more frequent moments of conscious participation and openness, at some point, as at least the way I said it in the book, was that at some point, a sort of an experiential center of gravity might shift. And even though we continue to go into identification with our conditioned history, with, you know, form, that there's a certain confidence that starts to arise that, my most intimate experiencing is already and always that of openness. There's nothing I have to do to discover openness. I don't have to heal my neuroses. I don't have to do 100,000 prostrations. I don't have to do this or that. It might be helpful, yes, as a path issue, but that openness, that freedom, experience of freedom, you know, whatever language we use, is, we find out it's always present if we direct our attention in an effective way. I mean, we can direct our attention in ineffective ways, of course.
Wrapping up here with a quote, a paraphrase from your book that I quite liked about that particular point. The idea was that neurosis or struggle is an incredibly complex and effective way to pretend to ourselves that we're dealing with our life and working on our problems while guaranteeing that nothing will happen.
Yeah.
It's like falling through the air, creating problems that promise themselves to you that they'll help you stop falling through the air.
Yeah, they basically serve as a distraction. Like, I forget if I said it, but it's like you're falling through space. You don't know when and where that might end or something, but you have a little backpack and you pull out a little pup tent or something and put it together as you're falling through space and then climb inside the pup tent. Now you feel, oh, now I'm safe because I've removed myself from that awareness. Like you were talking about earlier about that groundless ground being lost, that awareness. But so now I'm in my little pup tent, or Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about cocoon. And the point of the neurotic function is to make sure that my distraction continues. But I don't like the unnecessary suffering that is inevitably one component of neurotic avoidance. And so I pretend that I'm trying to resolve my neurosis while simultaneously, and part of me is, but simultaneously I'm going to make sure it never gets resolved because that would lose its distractive function.
And we also kind of reify the project of solving that by trying to heal or do self-work. And so this other facet here that seems important is the sense of giving up any fantasy of resolution.
I would say that would be helpful to give up any fantasy of resolution, but it doesn't mean give up one's efforts to improve the quality of one's experiencing. That's just intelligent. You know, if you have a house and the roof is leaking, you might want to fix it. But improving the quality of our experiencing is different than self-improvement. Because, again, any efforts to improve ourselves would mean that we might have to give up our familiar sense of self. And most people are invested in what's familiar because it feels safe and they know how to do it. So pretty much all of us are dealing with these contradictory impulses to want to figure out how to improve and change the quality of our experience without having to risk loss of our familiar sense of self. But, you know, you don't really significantly change your experience without having to let go of a familiar sense of self. So we have mixed feelings about all these things.
Wrapping up, towards the at the end of the book, you describe how anything that one might want is, say, already available.
Well, I wouldn't say that myself, unless I already said it. I mean, I know that's a common spiritual thing, but I don't agree with it.
Okay. So
I'd like $1 billion. I actually would. It would be nice, you know, but it's not available to me. I'd like to jump off a cliff and fly. I'm not going to take that risk, you know.
There was a sense of there being qualities of experience that if one felt were lacking, that if you showed up with the willingness to look for them, that you seem to be saying that you felt confident that they were already available.
Well, I don't think it's only semantics, but it might be. What I'm referring to is that experience of openness or freedom, which has no ascribable qualities to it. It's just non-graspable, and that is always available. Yes, it's always present, as far as I can tell. But that doesn't mean qualities of experience are. It's not like I can be more aesthetically sensitive or more empathic than I happen to be at any moment just because I meditate.
Okay. I would like to offer you an open space here to share any like final words with the audience, any ways of summarizing and getting at the core of your book and your...
Yeah, I don't really have a message to share. So I could just pass on a basic Buddhist view, which is my training, which is that the two relative components of Buddhist practice could be understood as both compassion and awareness. And that makes sense to me. And on a relative level, that might mean sort of a practice of embodied immediacy, if that makes sense to somebody, where we're bringing our attention back to immediate experience with just curiosity, because we're only living in the present moment ever. So, you know, we'll probably handle our life more skillfully if we consciously participate in the only moment we're ever living in. That just makes sense to me. And then on the compassion side, a relative experience is just a practice of unconditional kindness toward everything that arises in that awareness, whether we like it or don't like it, even kindness to our refusing to be kind to ourselves, because it's unconditional kindness. So the practices of immediacy, practice of unconditional kindness, I think are very reliable and I think it's sort of hard to go wrong with those practices.
If people want to find or follow you, where are the best places to do that?
Not so easy. You know, I'm an old guy heading into retirement, so I have a website and I still am working with people, but I have more people interested, then I have space available. So sometimes, you know, frequently I'm not available, but I am still working. And I don't do anything on social media. So I think that's what follow refers to. So I don't have anything that I know that people could follow. I'd encourage people just to follow their own sort of intuitive intelligence and keep checking out anything that seems to be helpful and seems to speak to both their intelligence and their open-heartedness, and, you know, see how things unfold.
All right, Bruce, thank you so much. It's so much fun. I love connecting with you.
Well, it's fun talking with you. Good luck with your podcast and everything.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. If you found this episode valuable, you can help support the show by joining us on Patreon, link in the description. There you'll be able to get access to additional benefits that aren't available publicly. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to this show on YouTube or on your preferred podcasting platform by searching for Mew.